Thank you very much for the introduction. So there will be nothing new in this talk. I'm going to give you some review on this field theory aspects of quantum spin ice. So I'm going to stick to the basics, not to talk about something too realistic, if you like. But Michelle asked me specifically that there should be no Mickey Mouse in this talk, meaning that I have to do some serious business. So it's gonna be a little bit more serious than the usual sort of wave mechanics talk. So this is sort of the outline. So I'm gonna start with the physics of classical spin ice, and then I'm gonna basically use XXG model as a basis to think about a quantum spin ice problem. So this is really the simplest model we can think about for the quantum spin ice physics. So we sort of derive quantum electrodynamics using this XXG model. Then I will talk about this electromagnetic duality. So people talk about, you know, electric monopoles and magnetic monopoles, and we are just swimming in the soup of terminologies, and sometimes it's very confusing. So I like to clarify some of these terminologies. So then what are the excitations in the system? What would be the signatures in the experiment? There's some numerical work related to this model. Then I will make some comments about the realistic model. So that's the plan. Okay. So it will be more like a Beauty and the Beast rather than the Mickey Mouse today. Okay. So this is the model. So this is the minimal model. So this is the Ising, nearest neighbor Ising interaction between two spins, two nearby spins on the particle lattice. So you can write this in terms of the total spin in each tetrahedron, and then the sum over all tetrahedron. So we are very familiar with that. Then quantum fluctuation is given by this transverse spin-spin coupling. So you can have, here I'm specifically choosing ferromagnetic XY coupling here. And that's sort of more relevant to the physics of quantum spin ice. But you could have chosen a positive sign. In fact, in early years, one of the motivations to think about this model was ultimately study the Heisenberg model on the anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg model on the particle lattice. And it was infinitely difficult to do that. So people decided that why don't we start from a classical Ising model, then add basically XY term as a perturbation. And then ultimately, the hope was that by doing so, we can also understand something about anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg model on the particle lattice. We didn't quite achieve that yet. So initially, people studied the anti-ferromagnetic sign here, but you will see that it doesn't really matter so much whether we have a positive sign or a negative sign. One nice thing about the ferromagnetic XY coupling here is that this entire model can be simulated using quantum Monte Carlo. If you had a positive sign, you cannot do that. So that's one interesting thing. So. So for the classical model, when J perv is zero, so obviously the ground state in this manifold, two in, two out, this is basically classical spin ice, where the total spin on each tetrahedron is zero. So the question is, if you add transverse coupling, let's say if I add some small transverse coupling, whether you can induce something interesting, some quantum ground state. And obviously, if XY coupling is much, much bigger than Ising coupling, you just get a usual XY ferromagnet. So this is analogy to electrostatics for the classical spin ice. This is sometimes called magnetostatics. So basically, the argument is as follows. Imagine that this I represents the particle lattice site where all the spins reside. Then imagine that I'm thinking about a diamond lattice that can be obtained by connecting the center of the tetrahedron. That becomes a diamond lattice. So diamond lattice looks like that. So instead of thinking about the spin operator at the particularity site, I can put this spin operator at the link on the diamond lattice, essentially. So these are the particle lattice site. These are the diamond lattice site. So it's useful to think about a spin sitting at the middle of the link in the diamond lattice. So the RL prime link basically connect to diamond lattice site. So if you do that, so if you do so, then you can define this oriented vector field. So imagine that I call this SG operator, say depending on whether I'm pointing from A sub lattice to B sub lattice, or B sub lattice to A sub lattice, or diamond lattice, I choose a plus minus sign. Then I define some kind of electric field operator. So this electric field lives on the link of the diamond lattice. And this is essentially the G component of the spin operator. But the reason why we want to define this way is that if we do so, then this becomes an oriented vector field, meaning that if I switch R and R prime, I'm switching A and B sub lattices, they change sign. So that's important, right? That's the way that we want to define this vector field. And if you do that, then you immediately realize that using this definition, if I sum up all the electric field, say I'm sitting at, say, A sub lattice here, and there are four neighbors, they're all in the B sub lattice. If you sum them up, and that basically amounts to the total, there's a spin, G component to spin on the particle in each tetrahedron. So divergence of E, essentially, is given by this number, is given by the G component of the total spin in each tetrahedron. Okay. So if that's the case, in the ground state, in the classical ground state of the spin ice, this has to be always zero. So this gives me immediately this condition that the divergence of E will be always zero, right? So I get this this condition. So this is called electrostatics. So I mean, in the literature, a lot of people use magnetostatics language. Imagine that instead of electric field, obviously you can define a magnetic field, then you will get divergence of B equals zero condition. It's basically the same thing. I'm just using this language. So now you see that if you start from say two tetrahedron, so here I have one tetrahedron, two in, two out, another one with a two in, two out. Now if you flip one of the spin from say so down to up, then you create a so-called electric monopole, anti-monopole pair, in the sense that I have here, three in, one out, and here three out, one in, right? So the net spin is not zero anymore in each tetrahedron. So here, again, I'm using this language that I'm creating electric monopole, anti-monopole pair. In literature, quite often people say that these are the magnetic monopole, anti-monopole. It's just that you can change E to B, and that's essentially what it is. And I'll explain why I want to call that electric field instead of magnetic field later, but this is basically what we already know. So one thing I like to mention is that when you flip this spin, the net change in G component of the spin quantum number is 1. So essentially, this much excitation arises here by flipping this spin. But this spin flip is shared by two tetrahedron, right? Two tetrahedron. So if you separate this monopole anti-monopole pair to a large distances, then you realize that in that case, essentially, each tetrahedron will carry only half of this quantum number, right? So if you separate monopole anti-monopole pair in a long distance, so when they are close to each other, it's clear that the total spin quantum number changes basically in 1. When they're separated away, basically only half of them will be carried by each. So each one of them actually carry a spin half quantum number. So in that sense, this electric monopole is a spinor because they carry a spin half quantum number. It's a fractionalized quantum number. Okay. So next. So quantum spin ice, now I like to add this transverse coupling. So to, then essentially we do a degenerate perturbation theory, assuming that this is the original Hamiltonian, this is the perturbation. Then you realize that you have to go to like third order in perturbation theory to have an effective Hamiltonian. And the reason why you have to go to third order is that basically in the degenerate perturbation theory, you want to make sure that after doing all this perturbation, you're going back to the ground state. Basically your effective Hamiltonian, for example, should commute with this constraint. So only up to, only at the third order, you can basically do that. And that's why this so-called ring coupling is given by this J-perp, the transverse coupling to the cube divided by the Eigen coupling to the scale. Okay, so you can also think about some kind of quantum dynamo model related to this kind of ring exchange term. So the usual argument is that if you think about the corresponding dynamo model is like having two diamonds touching each side on the dynamo lattice. So this can be explained in a very simple way that if you take one tetrahedron, then we have two out, two in spin configuration. Then basically you are saying that in the corresponding dynamo lattice, basically this up spin and down spin corresponds to, let me see why it doesn't, oh, the other way. Okay, so this up spin, so for example, when you have an up spin that corresponds to having a dynamo, down spin that corresponds to not having a dynamo. So in that case, you can see that for each dynamo lattice site, basically you have two dimers touching the dimer lattice site, but there's no dimer in the other two directions. So we have this say dimer configuration. So that dimer configuration has one-to-one correspondence to a classical spin-ice configuration. Then the quantum dynamics essentially generated by basically flipping these dimers around the hexagon. So you have some kind of flippable hexagon, and dimers are moving around. That's essentially the same as this ring exchange Hamiltonian. This model cannot be solved immediately. So what these people did was they add some dimer potential term by hand. So this is not part of the effective Hamiltonian, but imagine that you add this term. Then if you go to so-called RK limit, Roxhart-Kibelsen limit, namely that when the strength of the ring exchange term is exactly the same as the potential energy term, then this model can be solved exactly. And the resulting state is spin liquid. And this is a special kind of spin liquid state. The ground state is exactly the equal superposition of all dimer configuration. So the weight on each dimer is basically exactly the same. But notice that this is very, very far from the effective Hamiltonians. Basically, this can be solved only when you add this term, and this added term has to be, you know, almost as big as the original term. So you cannot easily argue that this model will support quantum spin liquid state, a quantum spin ice quantum spin liquid state, even without the potential term. So it's not a trivial question. For example, this model will support quantum spin liquid ground state or not. Okay, so then these are all in the large Eigen limit already. Okay, so in order to make a progress, so what you can do is as follows. So in order to do this calculation more quantum mechanically, you can introduce so-called quantum rotor variable. So for example here, So you represent the spin creation operator as e to the I phi. So phi is some kind of phase of the boson. You can think about this as a boson operator, boson creation operator. And this is the boson number operator. And the boson number can be only 0 or 1 because spin, g component of spin can be only half and minus half. So if n is 0, when there's no boson, I have minus half. If there's a 1 boson at site at a given link, then I get a spin half quantum number. So and the phi is just a conjugate variable. So they are just a canonical conjugate, just like a momentum and the coordinate of the system. So these are the the hardcore, this is called hardcore boson mapping, because you can only have zero or one boson, but not more than one boson. Okay, so in this language, you can write down an effective Hamiltonian like this. So this is the ring exchange term I just talked about. This K is basically the ring exchange, and since this term was basically written in terms of this creation, the S plus and S minus term, I can rewrite it as a combination of this phase variable like this. And this is the result of softening the hardcore boson constraint. So if U is infinity, then it's clear that N can be only 0 or 1. There's no other way, because in order to minimize energy. But if U is finite, then boson number in principle can fluctuate. So this is like softening this hardcore boson constraint. But nonetheless, this is some kind of useful effective Hamiltonian. And this becomes exactly the hardcore boson limit when U by K is large, right? When U by K is infinity, you're basically going back to the hardcore boson limit. So the idea is to study this model and think about what happens in the large U limit. And that should be equivalent to the original spin model. Is it clear? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so this is the way that quantum electrodynamics mapping works. So we define an electric field just like before. So this SC operator up to plus minus sign defines the electric field. And then you can also define a vector potential. And these variables are all defined on the link of the diamond lattice. And that vector potential essentially corresponds to this phase variable of the boson. And you notice that since number operator and phase variable of the boson are conjugate variable, electric field and vector potential should also become a conjugate variable. So if you think about, say, electric field as a coordinate, then the A vector potential will be a momentum. And this is essentially what happens in usual quantum electrodynamics. The electric field and magnetic vector potential are canonically conjugate. Okay. And notice that the electric field acquires a half integer value, not the integer values. And this comes from the fact that we are dealing with the spin-hop operator. And this will be quite important in the later discussion. So I stole this figure from Nick Shannon's paper. This is just showing the diamond lattice. Actually, I'm not showing the down up tetrahedron. It's showing only the down tetrahedron. But nonetheless, all the links are the links of the diamond lattice, and all this electric field and vector potential are defined on this link. Okay, good. So in this language, the U term I talked about becomes electric field square, right? Because there was like n minus half square. Then the ring term essentially given by sum over all this vector potential around the hexagon, right? So is that clear? Yeah. Good. So this sum over this vector potential around the hexagon, essentially, you can think of that as a curl of the vector potential around the hexagon. And just like before, the divergence of E is given by this the total G component spin in each tetrahedron. So this becomes a Gauss law. And it's just this definition of curl of A in electrodynamics. And you immediately notice that there is some kind of gauge invariance, namely that if you shift your vector potential or the phase variable of the boson by this much at different sites, so chi r prime minus chi r, all this chi shift, they all cancel out in this form. So curl of A is invariant under this gauge transformation, just like a usual electrodynamics. Right? So just to remind you, we started from this Hamiltonian. This becomes an electric field. And the phi is the vector potential. So this combination becomes sum over vector potential around the hexagon. So that becomes a sum over electric field around the hexagon that becomes a curl of magnetic vector potential. This becomes electric field. So that's that. Good. So that's essentially the mapping. So one way to think about this is as follows. So pictorially, so since you know it's more difficult to draw pictures in diamond lattice, this is the analog in the cubic lattice. It's much easier to think about in the cubic lattice. So if I have if I define the vector potential at the link of the cubic lattice, then sum over all this link variable corresponds to the curl. So you see that this represents the curl of this magnetic vector potential. The divergence is essentially sum over all this. For example, in the cubic lattice, there are six neighbors, so you have to sum over electric field along this link about the six neighbors, and that gives you the divergence of E. So in that case, it's natural to define a magnetic field as this curl of A. So this geomagnetic field will be essentially perpendicular to the each plane, and it's given by the circulation of this vector potential like that, in each plane, in three dimension. So it's very, very natural to define magnetic field at the link of the dual cubic lattice, where the dual cubic lattice is given by connecting the centers of the cube. Then basically dual cubic lattice will be like interpenetrating the original cubic lattice. Is it clear? Yeah, I hope it is. So I'm going to call the original cubic lattice. So I'm going to call original cubic lattice the direct lattice, the dual cubic lattice that's penetrating this original cubic lattice is a dual cubic lattice. So this RL prime with this notation is connecting two sides in the dual cubic lattice, not the original cubic lattice. So these links are penetrating the centers of the square surfaces. And that's the way that, so the magnetic field is actually defined on the link of the dual cubic lattice. So if you do so, on the diamond lattice, again, I can do the same. Essentially, your magnetic field is defined on the dual diamond lattice. So the red curve, red arrows are the original direct diamond lattice. The blue curves, blue arrows are the dual diamond lattice. So this magnetic field is defined on dual diamond lattice, but essentially it's penetrating the surface of spanned by this hexagon, and so in that sense, this magnetic field is defined as a curl of A, just like ordinary electrodynamics. So if you do so, then it's very, very natural to arrive at this Hamiltonian, namely that I have an electric field square, and this is almost magnetic field square, except that I have a cosine here. So normal electrodynamics will be given by electric field square plus magnetic field square, right? That's the usual Hamiltonian for the electrodynamics. But here, instead of E square plus B square, I have a cosine of B, essentially. And the reason why you get that is because we are on the lattice. And it turns out that is actually quite important. Okay. So one thing you notice is that in this definition, because of the fact that in the Hamiltonian, I have a cosine of B instead of B square, the B is a periodic variable. Namely that if I change pi times B by 2 pi, my Hamiltonian is invariant, right? So in that sense, pi times B by 2 pi, my Hamiltonian doesn't change. So they are equivalent solution. So in that sense, magnetic field is a periodic variable. And it's going to be very important that is periodic. Okay. So the question is, what is the divergence of B here? In free space, in usual electrodynamics, so divergence of B is zero, right? There is no magnetic monopole. Yeah? Divergence of B is typically zero because there is no magnetic monopole. You will see that on the lattice, because of the fact that this is periodic, I think I'm not familiar with this. So because of the fact that On the lattice, the Hamiltonian invariant on the disk transformation or B is periodic. You will see that this is not necessarily zero, and that's actually quite important. So one way to appreciate this is as follows. So look at this diagram in the cubic lattice. So I told you that I can define a magnetic field for each face of the cube. So the divergence of B is a sum over all this contribution. That will be the total divergence of B, right? And very, very naively, this should be zero, because you see that if I think about those arrows, so these are the direction of the link variable A. If you look at the nearby face, for example, this arrow given by the black arrows, then these contributions are all canceled by the purple. And these contributions are all canceled by the green, and et cetera, et cetera. So very, very naively, you should get zero. The divergence of B should be zero. And that's essentially the reason why there's no magnetic monopole in free space. But the point is that on the lattice, B is a periodic variable, namely that B and B plus 2 are basically equivalent contribution. So when you're taking a divergence, there's a singular contribution coming from periodic structure that the net sum is not zero. In fact, one of the B can be deeper by 2. And because of that, if you compute the net divergence, it can be an even integer. Okay. So because of that, the divergence of B is in general even integer, and it can be finite. That actually means that you can have a magnetic charge or magnetic monopole. And the existence of magnetic monopole is basically guaranteed by this periodic structure. And remember that periodic structure comes from the fact that I have electrodynamics on the lattice, not in free space. So that actually makes a distinction. So on the lattice, because of that, on the lattice you can have a magnetic monopole, but we don't have that in free space. Okay. So in that sense, people say this gauge theory or electromagnetism is compact. It just means that the Hamiltonian is the periodic and magnetic flux. That's what people mean by that. And when you do this, then your magnetic charge, so to speak, is quantized. Basically, you can only have an even integer, and because divergence of B is given by magnetic charge. So magnetic charge is finite and quantized. And also because of this, you can have a magnetic monopole in this system. Okay. So in the literature, a lot of people call this electric monopole. So this, the previous one, the spin one I talked about, quite often is called a magnetic monopole. Quite often this is called electric monopole. But physics is invariant on the name transformation, right? So it doesn't matter how you call that, but that's essentially what it is. Okay, good. So people talk about confinement in this theory. So you will see that the ground state of this Hamiltonian is not easy to figure out. It's actually against our intuition. The argument goes like this. So if you think about a small U limit, if U is small, right, then meaning that K is relatively big. So basically this means K is big, U is small. If K is big, then I want to have a definite value of color of A. So for example, I want to have a zero color of A because that minimizes energy, essentially. What that means is that I can expand my cosine. So if I do a tail expansion, the leading order will be curl A squared. That's essentially a magnetic field. So I end up with E squared plus B squared Hamiltonian. And that's essentially the ordinary electromagnetism we know. That's basically the Coulomb phase, right? That's basically the Coulomb phase. But now if you go to a large U limit, and in fact, that's the limit we are interested in. I think my point is not really working. Yeah. So this is really the limit that we are interested in, the large U limit. Now imagine that my electric field was integer valued. In our model, it's not integer value. It's like half integer value. Imagine that it was integer values. Then the vacuum, the ground state of this model, will be very trivial because if U is big, I basically want to have a zero electric field. right? I don't want to have electric field at all. That means that your charge is basically confined because you cannot possibly have electric field. In fact, in this case, there should be a confinement transition at some critical u by k, namely that if u is smaller than some number, then you are in the Coulomb phase. If u becomes too big, or k becomes too small, then your charge is confined. Basically, you don't have, for example, spin-on excitations. You don't have electric monopole, or maybe in some people's language, magnetic monopole doesn't exist. Okay, but and remember that essentially this is the limit that we are interested in. The original hardcore constraint can be obtained only when I'm taking a large U limit. That was the original model. Remember that I softened this condition. So this is not a relevant regime. Actually, we are interested in this regime. So this would have meant that basically I have a confinement, and basically you don't have a quantum spin ice or the quantum spin liquid. But what saves us is the fact that electric field is actually half integer. And it essentially comes from the fact that spin basically has a spin half character. So if you have half integer values like this, then essentially your electric field can be plus minus half. So there's an energy cost, but there's an equal energy cost. So the vacuum in this limit is actually frustrated. This is related to the frustration of the classical spin ice. And because of this, this becomes a non-trivial problem. The question is, what happens in this limit? So we know that in the small U limit, this is a Coulomb phase. But the hope is that because of the frustration, even if we go to a large U limit, that's the original limit, we still have a Coulomb phase. That's the hope. If that's the case, then we know that the original ring exchange Hamiltonian gives us the quantum spin ice, quantum spin liquid. So I just want to emphasize that this is a non-trivial question. The answer is not so obvious. Because in the usual electrodynamics, we should have gotten a confined phase. OK. So before I talk about the consequence of this theory, it's also useful to think about an electromagnetic duality. So the way it works is as follows. So remember that my magnetic field is given by color A. And my magnetic field actually lives on the dual diamond lattice. My vector potential lives on the direct lattice. It's a little confusing, but in fact, this is the ordinary way to think about quantum electrodynamics on the lattice degree of freedom. So, but then it's clear that just like the direct case of direct lattice, I can think about a conjugate variable of my magnetic field. Remember that on the direct lattice, my electric field and vector potential are conjugate variable, just like a coordinate momentum. So if I define a magnetic field, there must be another conjugate variable, and that I call alpha. So alpha is an analog of vector potential A, but I define it on the dual lattice, So B and alpha will be conjugate. So B and alpha will live on the dual diamond lattice. E and A will live on the direct diamond lattice. Okay, and they are basically, related by condition that magnetic field is given by curl of A. The integer part of the electric field is given by curl of alpha. So circulation of alpha gives us electric field. Circulation of A gives me a magnetic field. So this is a one-to-one correspondence, right? So if you like, you could have defined B and alpha on the direct lattice, E and A on the dual diamond lattice. It doesn't matter. It's just a matter of naming convention. But the physics is a little different. I will explain why. Okay. Good. So using this duality, you can write down two equivalent Hamiltonians. So this is the Hamiltonian written on the direct diamond lattice. So here I use electric field and the vector potential. Both variables are defined on the direct lattice. Alternatively, I could have chosen to work with magnetic field and the conjugate vector potential alpha, right? I could have done that. So again, if I could expand this cosine, this would be like electric field square plus magnetic field square. That's the usual Coulomb phase Hamiltonian. If I could expand this, again, I'll get the, this is essentially electric field square, magnetic field square, the same thing. Okay, and this is basically Maxwell's equation, that the divergence of B is an even integer. B is given by colorway. Divergence E is zero. This is the spin-ice constraint. And the electric field is given by colorway, right? And as simple as that. Okay. Okay. So the electromagnetic duality is nothing but the duality between electric field and magnetic vector potential on the direct diagonal lattice and the B and alpha field on the dual diagonal lattice. And you can switch back and forth. Either you can work with this Hamiltonian or you can work with that Hamiltonian. So and they are essentially equivalent. Okay. Any questions so far? Yeah. I'm hoping that I'm not stretching the equations too much. But Good. So if you go to a Coulomb phase, namely the deconfined phase, then as I explained, you could expand cosine, and then basically you can just retain a B square term. That essentially becomes B square plus electric field square. And if you get that, then both electric charge and magnetic charge are interacting each other with the usual 1 over R Coulomb potential. And this is the Coulomb phase that we want to discover, for example, in the experiment. The question is whether this model is in this phase or not. And that's not a trivial question. Good. So what are the excitations of this system? Basically, the first thing is the electric monopole. And you know, some people call it magnetic monopole. But these are the spin-on. And so one single spin flip will create spin-on anti-spin-on pair, or electric monopole anti-monopole monopole pair. So they'll be given by J sub z. Then you can also create a magnetic monopole. And that the strength of the magnetic monopole, energy scale of the magnetic monopole is basically given by the ring exchange term. So remember that the magnetic field is given by colorway. Colorway is nothing but this combination of a phase variable. So these are the, each one of them corresponds to the XY spin coordinate. And this is some relative orientation of XY component of the spin around the hexagon that gives me the B. And magnetic monopole is nothing but the fluctuation of B. So what magnetic monopole represent is the fluctuation, some collective fluctuation of XY component of the spin variable. So when this combination of XY spin configuration changes, it changes rapidly, that corresponds to a magnetic monopole excitation. The energy scale for that is essentially given by the ring exchange term. So in that sense, this is the energy scale for the magnetic monopole. I hope it's clear. Okay. And you can, of course, also have emergent photons. And the photon velocity are essentially given by this square root of two coefficients in the Hamiltonian, U and K, normalized by some lattice constant. But you may say, well, U is supposed to be infinity according to this hardcore boson mapping. But the hope is that in the low energy limit, essentially, in the short distance limit, U has to be infinity. But in the low energy limit, U becomes finite, and that essentially sets the velocity of the light. So we don't necessarily know what the value of U is in the low energy limit. We know what K is, but we don't necessarily know what the value of U is. Because there's some number that will be emergent in the low energy. So at least that's the hope. Okay. Good. So this photon will obviously contribute to the heat capacity and the thermal conductivity because they all carry entropy. Using this, you can evaluate the spin structure factor. So this is the computation of equal time spin correlator. So since SG operator is essentially an electric field operator, the SG-SG correlator is directly related to electric field correlator in the quantum electrodynamics. So this is, I'm assuming that we are in the Coulomb phase. The Coulomb phase, you just evaluate electric field correlator that will directly give you the spin-spin correlation function. And this guy has this form, and notice that it decays like 1 over r to the fourth power. And this is different from the spin correlation you remember in a classical spin ice. The classical spin ice, the spin-spin correlation function decays like 1 over r cubed. So it decays actually faster. And that one has a consequence, namely that if you look at the equal time structure vector, then comparing classical and quantum case, so classical case, there's no reason to distinguish equal time correlator or the static correlator. It's just, just the usual, basically you only have equal time correlator. And that one has this pinch point. So I'm borrowing this figure and all that from the Nix paper. So because of the fact that in the quantum case, the equal time correlator decays 1 over r to the fourth power, there is this additional power of k, momentum. And because of that, basically, you lose this pinch point. This is basically the reason why in the quantum case, if you go to t equals 0 limit, the zero temperature limit, and look at the equal time spin correlator, then you don't see a clear pinch point in the quantum case. That's because of this additional power of k. And they essentially relate to the fact that the equal time spin-spin correlator actually decays like 1 over r to the fourth instead of r to the cube, right? Okay. So as I said, it's not so obvious that the ground state of this model actually gives you the Coulomb phase as the ground state. So in early days, we decided to simulate this model. So as I said, this choice of sign doesn't have a sign problem, so we can actually simulate this. Another way to look at the same model is that basically using this hardcore boson mapping, you can map this problem to a boson problem. Basically, the boson hopping is given by this transverse XY term, and the boson interaction is given by the Ising term, so they are related to each other. And if you simulate this model, then this is the phase diagram, namely that this interaction V or J sub G is measured in terms of T. So at some very large values of coupling, you have a transition from the ferromagnet to a quantum paramagnet. That we think is a spin liquid or the quantum spin ice. So in fact, if you measure the spin stiffness for the ferromagnetic order, then it basically vanishes here. So there is a transition. The question is, what is the nature of the quantum paramagnetic state you see in the quantum Monte Carlo data? So what you can do is as follows. Assuming that the ground state in the large coupling limit is basically in the Coulomb phase, you can write down an effective Hamiltonian for quantum electrodynamics. So this will be the Hamiltonian for the Coulomb phase. Then using this, you can derive expression of equal time correlator and static correlator. So equal time correlator and static correlators are related to each other. And if you remember, equal time correlator is an integral over frequency of a dynamical structure factor. The static correlator is just omega equals zero limit. So this represents the elastic scattering, if you like. And this guy will pick up the inelastic contribution if you're a neutron scatterer, right? So this is equal time correlator, is steady correlator. In the classical limit, basically all the weights are in the elastic scattering. You don't really have an inelastic contribution at t equals zero, for example. So for quantum problem, these two correlators should be different, right? So what we did is follows. So we can derive analytic expression of this each correlator, and along different direction, we can fit, say, equal time correlator along different directions in on the lattice. So we have the spin-spin correlator derived from quantum electrodynamics Hamiltonian. Then you we fit the equal time correlator. Then using the same parameter set, you can try to see whether that works for the static correlator. This is a very, very over-constrained fit, right? Because you know, I'm fitting only one. First of all, I have to fit this for every lattice direction. So this is already non-trivial that it actually works out. But after that, I only have a small number of free parameters. But we fix this parameter, then fit the static correlator. And you see that they perfectly match. And this can only happen when the ground state in the strong coupling element is actually in the Coulomb phase. In fact, we can even see the quantum classical crossover in the sense that these two correlators are very different in the low temperature limit. If you increase temperature above crossover temperature, that basically becomes equal. So you are entering a classical region in that case. So there's an alternative quantum Monte Carlo simulation done by Nick Shannon's group. So instead of simulating the original model, they can also simulate the quantum dimer model. So this is the ring exchange term written in a quantum dimer language. This is the additional potential energy term you add, right? Remember that original, the effective Hamiltonian only has this term. There was no interaction term. But by simulating this, so this is the phase diagram. So this is the RK point that can be exactly solved. But it's not trivial to show the spin liquid phase or quantum spinized grounds exist even without this term. And they show that this is indeed the case. So they indeed show that even in the limit that you get rid of this guy, even with only this term, you actually have a quantum spin liquid. So in that sense, basically, you know, all the simulation results agree with each other. So this is a highly non-trivial check. Very recently, Onoda's group computed the heat capacity. And remember that there is an energy scale for the magnetic monopole excitation above which you are entering a classical regime, below which you're basically in the quantum spin ice regime. There is no finite temperature transition. You only have a crossover. But that crossover temperature scale is supposed to be given by energy scale of the magnetic monopole excitation. And they indeed see that around this energy scale, you see that the heat capacity start to rise, and also that your entropy, you know, basically is decreased after making this plateau. So you're basically entering a quantum regime below this temperature scale. So they can see that directly from the quantum Monte Carlo simulation. Also, this may be related to the talk that Yuji Matsuda-san may give on Friday. So they may have measured the thermal conductivity, and they have some evidence for perhaps magnetic monopole or the photon excitation in the thermal conductivity. More realistic model is given by this form. So as Jeff emphasized, we have not just Ising and XY term, you have also so other terms. And if you try to derive the effective Hamiltonian like this, then even without this J plus minus term, for example, this is the usual ring exchange term, but for example, Nick showed that if you include JG plus minus, you are generating all kinds of other interactions. So it's not easy to solve this model. So one way to make progress was to use this so-called gauge mean field theory. So the idea is to introduce spin-on degree of freedom explicitly using a constraint. So in the original formulation, we wrote down the theory only in terms of electric field and magnetic field. Basically, the matter content was implicit. Here, you introduce the spin-on creation and destruction operator explicitly, but you have to impose a constraint. The number operator for these spin-ons are essentially exactly given by the sum over G component of spin. That was the original constraint. So you introduce this constraint, then you can rewrite your the lower, raising and lowering operator spin and the G component like that. And if you do this, then again, you can make sure that There's a U1 gauge invariance on the U1 transformation for the spin-on field and essentially the magnetic vector potential. And that way, you can extend the previous theory to this theory with the basically spin-on field explicitly taken into account. So if you do this, then you end up with this famous phase diagram. Essentially, so for example, if your spin-ons are condensed, then you get into a magnetically ordered state. So your magnetically ordered state obtained by condensing spin-on degree of freedom, the in that sense, basically, it's got Higgs mechanism, namely, your spin-on, your bosonic Higgs field is condensed, and that's the way that you get about the gauge field that you enter conventional magnet. There's a more exotic phase here. This is called Coulomb ferromagnet. Here, you don't actually condense the spin-on, so you are still in the, you're still in the spinnicky state, but nonetheless, you can still have a magnetic order. So this is called the Coulomb ferromagnet. So sometimes it's called ferromagnetic star phase. It's a fractionalized magnetically ordered state. So one thing I like to emphasize, this is my last slide, is that in this mean field theory, basically there is no confinement physics. So in this mean field theory, we are assuming that this variable, essentially expectation value of e to the plus minus ia, is always finite. And this is because we are ignoring the monopole fluctuation. So if there's a monopole fluctuation, then this expectation value can be zero. And that would signal a confinement. So this mean field theory explicitly ignores the fluctuation of magnetic monopole. So it misses out any possible confinement physics. Also, another important implication is that if you go to a finite temperature, that you will always create a finite number of monopole. There will be a finite density of monopole. And that essentially screens out the long-range interaction. So strictly speaking, the U1 spinnicky phase, or Coulomb phase, is well-defined only at t equals 0. At finite temperature, according to strict definition, you don't really have a Coulomb phase. But you do have a crossover to a classical region. So when you're using this gauge mean field theory at finite temperature, you have to be a little bit careful. Because basically you miss out all this magnetic monopole on confinement physics. I think I'm going to close my talk here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
Graham. How does an experimentalist distinguish the Coulomb ferromagnet from the ferromagnetic phase?
The spin-spin correlation function, right? Basically, because of the magnetic ordering, you should have an elastic contribution, elastic peak, the break peak, yeah. But on top of that, you should have a photon excitation at the same time. Remember that here, photons are basically given by SGSG correlator. So if you measure the SGSG correlator, the fact that you have a photon excitation is built into that correlator. But on top of that, you should have an elastic contribution in the Newton scattering intensity, which will be absent in the pure quantum spin I space.
But how are the two ferromagnetic phases different?
In terms of ferromagnetic ordering, will be the same. But in the case of in ordinary ferromagnet, conventional ferromagnet, you don't have photon. You don't have excitation that look like a photon. Yeah. So that will be the distinction.
Bruce? So you and others have this nice plot of the dispersion for the photons going linearly in K. And I assume that what you were calling the electric monopole excitation is a gapped excitation.
Right, spectrum. Right.
And so what about the other one, what you would call the magnetic monopole.
Right.
So is that also gapped?
Yeah, so magnetic monopoles are also gapped. In fact, if magnetic monopoles are not gapped, then basically your Coulomb phase is not stable. So if quantum spin ice phase is stable ground state, the magnetic monopole should have a finite excitation gap. So for example, in principle, in heat capacity, in thermal conductivity, you should see an activation behavior at say, monopole, you know, magnetic monopole energy scale, that there should be another activation energy scale at electric monopole activation energy scale. So you should see at least two activation energy in ideal world, yes.
And then below that, TQ.
Below that, basically, you have a T-cube, actually, you know, heat capacity, yeah, in the low temperature limit.
Are these spin-ons fermions?
So in the language of gauge mean field theory that I talked about in the last slide, these spin-ons are actually bosonic. So that's the reason why when you condense those spin-ons, and that's the way that you enter a magnetically loaded state. But in theory, those spin-ons doesn't necessarily have to be bosonic. So it's known that you can make a bound state of this magnetic monopole and the bosonic spin-on. If you make a bound state, that becomes fermion, right? And it's possible that that bound state has a lower energy than the original bosonic spin-on. So it's possible, without changing the ground state, you can just change the energy scale of two kinds of spin-on excitation. In principle, we can have bosonic spin-on and fermionic spin-on. Here, the assumption is that energy scale of fermionic spin-on is so high that it's not in the low energy manifold. The only relevant thing is the bosonic spin-on. And by condensing that, I can go into a magnetically loaded state. But it's possible that without closing the gap, excitation energy scale for the fermionic spin-on becomes lower than bosonic spin-on. In that case, in the low energy manifold, you should see a fermionic spin-on instead of bosonic spin-on. But there was an explicit assumption in the gauge mean field theory that spin-ons are actually bosonic.
So how would the predictions of theories discussed here compare with experiment? You showed us some structure factor calculated two different versions.
Yeah, so that was not my job. But but in essence, you know, the idea is that if all the spectral weight is in the elastic contribution, that's essentially classical. But if you see spectral weight in the low frequency Newton scalar intensity, then chances are that you do have a significant amount of quantum fluctuation. You have a chance to see a quantum spin-off. Because you see, the reason why equal time correlator and the steady correlator differ in this calculation is precisely that. Basically, steady correlator only measures the elastic contribution. And the equal time correlator integral of all frequencies. So if you have a low energy spectral rate in the Newton scattering, you should see that it shows up in the equal time correlator, right? So it's just that, you know, it's just that I would love to compute dynamical correlator here. In the quantum Monte Carlo, we can only compute steady correlator, equal time correlator, unfortunately. So that we don't have a dynamic information. But that will be the implication.
Yeah, I have a technical question. So is this a numerical calculation of this correlation function in the momentum space, right? You're saying you are doing this fitting.
Yes.
So in the quantum case, one have this 1/r for decay. In the classical case, you have 1/r cube decay. This is important. The angular information is not is the same.
It's the same. That's
correct. And if you do Fourier transform into momentum space, now these dispersions are more sensitive to the angular dependence, not really sensitive to.
That's right.
To this, whether it's r cube, right?
Right.
So then, in what sense, you know, it's a quantum or classical in the momentum information?
In what sense? So there's an additional factor of k, for example.
Uh-huh.
Right? The momentum counting is very different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it captured in the correlation function calculation?
Yeah, it's in the lattice calculation. So you can compute the lattice correlation function exactly. So I mean, it requires the information about the sub lattices. You have, you know, you have to include all the tetrahedral. And
yeah,
everything.
Sure. You can do compact classification, which my company did in this paper. But there's some arbitrariness, I think, in how you do this.
So there is a fitting parameter. That's what I'm saying. There's fitting parameter. So that's the non-trivial information, right? So basically, there's a fitting parameter. And we fix one parameter set. I think next speaker is coming, so I have to.
Coming is right, actually.
Yeah. So there is a fitting parameter, and the trick is the non-trivial thing is one parameter set should fit every direction and also equal time and the steady correlation.
Yes,
so that's non-trivial.
Yes, thanks.
Okay, I think if you're going to want to eat at around 12, we should get going. So let's make a young tech for a very simple.